In this part of Focus, we will be talking about a trend in law enforcement that is becoming increasingly common, as well as increasingly popular. And that is something that, in technical terms, has been called order maintenance policing. But in popular media, it's often been referred to as the fixing broken windows approach. And we'll talk in some depth about exactly what that means. But briefly, what it means is it's an argument that says that going after what seem to be small, lower-level crimes and doing that aggressively will actually help reduce more serious crimes. It's become very popular in government and police circles and has been implemented in some big cities, New York City, for example. Our guest this morning, however, questions that. And in a book that we'll be talking about here, says that, in fact, there isn't a great deal of research to back up the idea that this kind of approach works. Our guest is Bernard Harcourt. He's professor of law at University of Arizona and at the moment is spending some time as a visiting associate professor at Harvard Law School. His book is titled Illusion of Order, The False Promise of Broken Windows Policing, and it is published by the Harvard University Press. Is available now in bookstores if you're interested in reading it. And of course, as we talk, your questions and your comments are welcome. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening on the internet, you can use it. Of course, if you're listening here around Illinois, Indiana, you can use that too, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL. Toll-free 800-222-WILO. Those are the numbers. Professor Harcourt, hello. Yep. Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. Just probably first, before talking about the points where you take issue with the idea, for people who aren't really sure what it is this is we're talking about, we ought to explain order maintenance policing and what exactly it is.
Sure. Order maintenance policing, or the broken windows approach, basically is an approach that focuses policing on minor disorder, a minor disorderly activity, some of which is criminal, some of which is just disorderly. So we're talking here about graffiti in a city like New York, turnstile jumping, or the famous squeegee men, folks who stand at the corner and want to clean your windshield wipe, your windshields. And the idea is that if we focus on those kind of minor activities and we eradicate those minor activities, that we're basically sending a message that will, in effect, reduce very serious crimes like armed robbery. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is to focus on small things and that's going to then have an effect on what we care more about, which is major crime.
And this is something that seems to have grown out of social science and been embraced then by people who were in government and law enforcement?
Well, it grew out of an article. It was an article by James Q. Wilson and George L. Kelling called Broken Windows. And the article itself, I'm not sure I would say grew out of social science. It was somewhat anecdotal. It kind of gave a story about how this might work, in fact. But subsequent to that, that was in 1982, subsequent to that, some researchers started to try and figure out if, in fact, there was any evidence to support the broken windows theory.
Why? Well, maybe let me ask you this question. Why is it, and it certainly does seem to be the case, in maybe New York City was one of the first places we'd really associate with this approach, but based on the perception of success there, it's been picked up and has been done other places.
That's
why
right.
is it that it seems to have such appeal and become so popular in municipal government circles and also in law enforcement?
Well, I think there's in part it's a huge coincidence that the policies were implemented at a time, for instance, in New York City about 1993 with Mayor Giuliani, at a time when throughout the country crime started coming down at very sharp rates. So we've seen in the last 8 years the most amazing reduction in crime across the country, but also beginning in cities like New York, large urban areas. So in part, I think there's been this coincidence that has fueled the kind of popularity of the broken windows policing approach. Another important part, I think, though, is that it offers an explanation or a way to think about activities that basically we didn't like before. I don't think anyone really, you know, in municipal government, in police departments, and lots of citizens didn't like graffiti and didn't like aggressive panhandlers and didn't like squeegee men. And before, there wasn't much of a theoretical or other than just a gut reaction that we don't like these kind of activities, there wasn't that much that explained why we should, in some sense, crack down on them. I think most people used to view them as nuisances, but nuisances aren't a reason why you would, you know, arrest people for these activities. Today, because of the broken windows theory, I think these activities have been converted from just a mere nuisance to a real tangible harm, something that really harms our society. And as a result of the broken windows theory, I think people are more willing now to crack down, to come down real hard on turnstile jumpers, squeegee men, homeless, etc. So I think that in some sense it's satisfied kind of a theoretical need that a lot of people had to explain why they were opposed to these kind of activities.
I would have thought that initially this would have been a tough sell with people in law enforcement, because they would have said, yeah, look, it's true. We don't like prostitution. We don't like vagrancy. We don't like vandalism. But, you know, if I was a police chief, I would say, I only have so many officers, and we have a lot of serious crime out there, and I'm going to send my officers to go after muggers and armed robbers and murderers and rapists. And, you know, the other stuff we might say, yeah, I don't like that, but, you know, I'm going to go over this, going to go after the stuff that's really, really bad, and that maybe then if I have any time left over, I can do these other things.
Right. Well, it's been part of a much larger shift in policing from what used to be called kind of responsive 911, kind of more reactive policing, where the big issue was the response time to calls. And the function, it was a very professionalized policing force that would respond to calls for assistance, and a shift from that, a large shift throughout the country towards something that is generally called community policing, a term that today has become really so vague that it's meaningless. But the idea basically being that we would have more kind of cops on the beat, involved in the community, knowing what's going on. And the broken windows theory was one particular kind of facet or aspect of the shift towards community policing. Often they're lumped together, but in fact there are lots of different approaches to community policing. And so I think it became popular in part because of this feeling that, you know, the 911 policing just wasn't working. And that, of course, was in part because it coincided with very high rates of crime in this country. Mm-hmm. So in the 70s and the 80s, towards the end of the 80s, with huge rates of crime in this country, people were starting to just be disenchanted with the, you know, prevailing police paradigm, which was one of reacting to citizen calls.
Yeah. And something else, just real quick, and then we can touch on it, and then I have a caller here I want to talk with. But something else that you note in the book that was happening at the same time, and in fact is really tangled with this approach, with increasing levels of crime, we also had increasing levels of incarceration.
Right. So we saw, since beginning in the 1970s, we saw huge increases in incarceration throughout the country. And I think that that's the trend that people have focused most on in terms of criticizing criminal justice during the late 20th century. I think people have focused mostly on what's called the, you know, incarceration mania. And the numbers are pretty astounding. I mean, if you look at a graph, it looks exponential. So in 1970, for instance, we had about 200,000 people incarcerated in state and federal prisons. And by the late 1990s, the number was up to about 1.2 million, with another 600,000 in jails in the country. And then as we entered the 21st century, we had approximately 2 million citizens in custody. in actual custody, state or federal prisons or jails. And so we've seen an enormous increase in incarceration over the last 30 years. And I think that it's, in fact, because of that that incarceration increase that broken windows theory became popular. It became popular as an alternative. It became popular as a more progressive alternative or liberal alternative because, in fact, the idea was instead of incarcerating so much, we could just try and tackle kind of the smaller disorder in the city and that that would have an effect on crime so that we wouldn't have to incarcerate. The point of my book is to suggest really that although order maintenance is offered as an alternative to massive incarceration, it turns out that it's really an addition to incarceration. Rather than being a substitute, it's become a supplement to the incarceration mania.
We should introduce here again our guest for anyone who's tuned in the last little bit here. We're speaking with Bernard Harcourt. He's Associate Professor of Law at University of Arizona. And at the moment is visiting at Harvard Law School. His book is Illusion of Order, The False Promise of Broken Windows Policing, published by Harvard University Press. Questions are welcome. We have someone here ready to go and would be happy to talk with others. All you have to do is dial us up. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. On the spectrum from these broken window crimes all the way up to things like armed robbery, where do you see racial profiling? It is a concern in this community in Champaign-Urbana, and it's become an issue in the state of Illinois. And my feeling is that racial profiling is not new for the black community. It has gone on, you know, forever. But I wonder if you are seeing in your charts whether there is an increase in racial profiling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really great question. And obviously, the whole approach to order maintenance policing is one that fosters a lot of police discretion, okay, in terms of what particular things to go after. These are minor crimes, these are disorderly conduct, etc. And the more you increase police discretion, the greater the risk of racial profiling. So racial profiling obviously is a central issue in this question of order maintenance policing. In New York City, a lot of research was done on the issue of stop and frisks. And the Attorney General of New York, Elliot Spitzer, issued a lengthy report with some researchers at Columbia, which reviewed the stop and frisks that had been conducted under the policy of, you know, aggressive disorder management, and found that there were, in fact, significant racial disparities against both blacks and Hispanics in New York City and the kind of policing that was going on there. I think that it's one of the problems that gets often overshadowed because of the popularity of broken windows policing, and because of this the rhetorical argument of how important it is to eliminate, say, you know, these major crimes, and how important it is to go for these minor offenses. And as a result of the importance of it, we often then tend to ignore these other aspects, such as racial profiling. In the book, I discuss the issue of racial profiling at length as a significant cost that really undermines the value of the policy here. Of course, the whole issue of racial profiling, I think it's hard to talk about today, post September 11th and the tragic events that occurred in New York and Washington, in the same way that we used to talk about them before the terrorist incidents. And so, in fact, all of these issues of policing have kind of changed somewhat.
Can you speak further on this? Because I'm not sure I know where you're going with your statements.
Yeah, well, all I'm suggesting is that I think that the events of September 11th created for many people a kind of one of the, you know, biggest or sharpest or most focused and most intense arguments for a kind of racial profiling that then raises questions about racial profiling and policing overall. So I've been involved in a number of debates about racial profiling where the issues seem to be sharpened as a result of the terrorist incidents. And I generally have taken the position that we have to find alternatives to racial profiling, even in these situations. But I think that it just has cast a shadow over those kind of debates and changed people's opinions about them.
Are you, by any chance, going to be speaking at the University of Illinois? Often David's guests do speak at the University of Illinois through the Miller Com and various other organizations.
I don't have any plans right now, but, I'll...
No, but if somebody wants to invite him, I'm sure he can come.
There you go.
By all means, yes. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
I think it's really it's really noteworthy, and we've talked about it a little bit in previous programs, just touching on the issue that the caller raised, is that I think significant numbers of Americans who previously, before September 11th, would have come out foursquare against racial profiling have changed their minds,
right?
And have said in response to surveys in very pointed questions, have said things like, "Well, people who are Arab American or even who look like it, that now they in large numbers of people would say it's okay to be profiling those people. It would be appropriate to require them to carry identity documents and all sorts of things that previously I think." A lot of people would have said no. They wouldn't go for that.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it does seem as if the racial profiling debates that we were having before have been, in some sense, kind of fundamentally altered. And sharpened in a certain way. Now that doesn't mean that one has to come out to a different result ultimately and a different bottom line, but it does mean that one has to do, I think, a little bit more work arguing for the downsides of racial profiling under these circumstances.
We have another caller. This is Clay City. It's our toll-free line, number 4. Hello.
Yes. I have a real... I mean, it's everybody is having to relook and rethink things. I mean, the 11th changed the whole paradigm of how we view people and crime.
Right.
But I'd like to know where our guests would draw the line. I mean, I don't like the idea of somebody stopping me on the street and frisking me. I think that's kind of Gestapo methods to policing, and I don't like that. I mean, you know, personally, you know, I find that offensive. You know, if I did nothing, you know, to have someone frisk me. But yet, I don't like the idea of letting petty crimes go. I mean, a crime is a crime, where are you going to draw the line? I mean, you're going to let people jump the gates and not do anything about it, or are you just going to slap their hands or throw them in jail the first time?
Right.
Draw the line.
Right. What I suggest is that there are alternatives to aggressive misdemeanor arrests. So, for instance, I mean, what we've seen in New York City over the past year since '93 is a sharp increase, about 50% increase in misdemeanor arrests for kinds of offenses like turnstile jumping, et cetera. What I try to suggest are different ways in which we could achieve the goals that we'd like without having the disadvantages of having an aggressive arrest policy. And so, I mean, in the turnstile jumping situation that you raised, there are other ways of trying to eliminate turnstile jumping, such as, you know, using turnstiles that can't be jumped, for instance. And a lot of cities have turnstiles that you actually can't get through them unless you've put your token in or you've slid your pass through. And New York City, of course, is installing some of those. And that's a technique that really goes towards, it's a technique of situational crime prevention, or kind of like target hardening is often called. But it's an approach that instead of focusing on what are equally expensive arrests, right, because it implicates the courts, it implicates the jails, et cetera, it focuses on trying to avoid that from even being a possibility. And so I think that what we've seen with the broken windows theory is really not enough creativity about how we would, in fact, produce order if that were our goal. Okay. So even assuming for a minute that we do want to produce order, there are lots of ways of doing it, and we can be a little bit more creative about how we do it rather than relying on the traditional and expensive mechanisms of police arrests.
We are just about at our midpoint of this part of Focus, and I want to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Bernard Harcourt. He teaches law at University of Arizona. Right at the moment is visiting associate professor at Harvard Law School. His book, Illusion of Order, The False Promise of Broken Windows Policing, is published by the Harvard University Press. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. And again, for anybody who might have tuned in here, what we're talking about here is looking at maybe order maintenance policing, what in popular media has been referred to as the broken windows or the fixing broken windows approach, that argues that if you get aggressive about low-level crimes, things like vandalism and graffiti and turnstile jumping and prostitution and things like that, that you can actually have an effect on more serious crime. And that's the point that I want to go to next, because it was a basic sort of argument that's been made about this approach and why anybody would argue that is something that you should do, because it said that, well, if you go after this low-level crime, you're actually going to have an effect on the really bad stuff. What you've done is taken a look at what sort of research there has been done to try to answer this question, well, does it actually work? Can we say that there is any sort of research that shows, well, yeah, that it does have that effect? Your conclusion is, in fact, no, you can't back that up.
Right. Right. I mean, I've looked at both the social scientific work that's been done on disorder and the kind of anecdotal evidence in cities like New York City. And the bottom line that I've come to is that really there's no good evidence that disorder causes crime. At the social science level, the study that's most often relied on is a study from 1990 by Professor Wesley Scogin, who's at Northwestern. And he looked at 30 different communities and tried to see whether there was a correlation between kind of physical and social disorder on the one hand, so residents' feelings about whether there's litter or prostitution, etc., on the one hand, and then robbery victimization on the other. And although he found a correlation with robbery victimization, when I went back to his data, which I obtained from the University of Michigan, it turned out that there were actually four other variables for crime. There was sexual assault, burglaries, and purse snatching. And none of those actually correlated with disorder. And then when one focused a little bit more on the robbery numbers, it turned out that there were certain neighborhoods in Newark which seemed to be having too much of an excessive influence on the results. And so it turned out that that didn't, in fact, support the correlation. Of course, correlation doesn't even prove causation, but to begin with, it didn't support the correlation. And then there's been some more recent work from the University of Chicago, Robert Sampson and Stephen Rodenbusch, who's at the University of Michigan, and they too came to the conclusion, a very detailed study, that basically in 4 out of 5 tests, there's no significant correlation between disorder and victimization, criminal victimization. So, I mean, there's, on the one hand, there's the social scientific evidence, which is at best unconclusive and possibly actually suggests that disorder doesn't cause crime, but rather that both disorder and crime have similar antecedents. And then I looked at the evidence in New York City and in other cities about whether, in fact, the crime drop could be linked to the increased order, and really concluded that there isn't any good evidence that the New York Police Department policies are responsible for the decrease. And so there, I think you have to start thinking about the fact that there are a number of large cities that have had the same decline in crime as New York City. In fact, some cities have had greater declines in crime, and yet a number of other cities have not adopted the same kind of aggressive misdemeanor arrest policies. So, for instance, one recent study which compared the 17 largest cities, their drops in crime put New York in 5th place behind San Diego, Boston, L.A., San Antonio, and Houston. San Diego, Washington, St. Louis, Houston. And if you look at some of those other cities, like San Diego, which had the highest drop in crime, they've really implemented a very different kind of policing. So to begin with, it's just not at all clear that New York City has seen different drops in crime than other cities who have not implemented this kind of policing. And then the brute fact is that there are a lot of other explanations for the drop in crime in New York. So people have studied the crack markets, and those have been in sharp decline, a shifting consumption of drugs, a good economy. There have been computer tracking systems that have been put in place in New York City. And of course, there's been a sharp increase in the police force. So when you start looking at those other factors, there are a lot of other explanations in New York City, and you basically my conclusion from looking at everything is that it's just what we saw in New York City was not because of increased orderliness.
I think you are suggesting that in drawing this relationship between order maintenance policing and the decrease of crime, that people are making what is a very common sort of mistake, and that is assuming that because two things are occur close together in space and time, there's causal relationship. You know, so
exactly.
We do that all the time.
Exactly.
But then that also maybe leads one to the, if that's what's happening here and we say that they're not related, that maybe, and you suggested there are other ways to think about the decrease in crime, it leads one to this comforting sort of conclusion that maybe one, the philosophy of policing that you adopt maybe doesn't have much. Maybe this is going too far, but what I was going to say is maybe it doesn't have all that much to do with crime rates.
Right. Well, that's obviously a big debate in policy and academic circles, is how much effect does the police actually have on crime rates? And obviously, throughout the ages, there have been a number of other factors, demographics, for instance, that people point to and suggest, that's what really is going to affect crime rates. It's not exactly the specific kind of policing that takes place in a particular jurisdiction. I think that we're often, it's an interesting debate because I don't think when crime rates increase, we blame the police. Right.
Mm-hmm.
We saw huge increases in crime rates across the country in the 1960s. Beginning in the 1960s, we saw peaks in the 1970s, 80s. 91 was the most recent peak across the country. I don't think that we would say, for instance, that those increases and those peaks were caused by police mismanagement. Right. However, when we see sharp declines, then it's often one of the first things we might turn to is proper police management. And so that's a little bit of an irony in the debates, I think. I would say that it's likely, the New York Police Department did a lot of different things beginning in 1993 under Commissioner William Bratton. And he significantly reorganized the force, reorganized the management of the force, and brought in much more of a computerized statistics approach with much greater accountability for precinct, the heads of the precincts, CompStat meetings, which have been a very popular thing that has been used in a number of other jurisdictions. So there were significant changes in the New York Police Department. And, of course, there was a huge increase in the number of police officers. So from about 92 to 96 in New York City, we saw about 6,000 new police officers in uniform, which increased the department by about 25%. The New York Police Department also merged in some transit and housing authority officers, 6,000 of those. So, and if you include those, the police force increased by 50%. So you saw a large increase in the police, the number of police officers, and also in the ratio of police officers per capita. And that obviously also is likely to have some effect on crime. If you have more police on the street, that's going to also implicate the production of crime. So the big question in New York City really is, well, things changed, and to what extent was it the creation of order, right? Because clearly there was more a certain type of order in New York, and to what extent was it these other changes at the NYPD? And what I suggest in the book is that one of the important factors here is the fact that broken windows theory allowed for a lot more surveillance, basically. And basically, if you arrest 50% more people for misdemeanor arrests, for misdemeanors and disorder, you get to search them, you get to frisk them, you get to check whether they're carrying guns, you get guns off the street, you get to check whether there's an outstanding warrant for their arrest. And those kind of enhanced surveillance mechanisms also probably contributed to some extent to the drop in crime in New York City. Was it order, though? I really don't think so.
We have some other callers here, and in fact, someone from a car phone. We'll get right to them. Line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Listen, I was just concerned if the process that the police use to go against crime doesn't make any difference. Why are you concerned about the process that they use?
Right. Well, I think that I was particularly concerned because of some of the negative consequences of this kind of policing, in part because of the racial profiling that was taking place in a city like New York, which the first caller mentioned, but also because of some of the other negative consequences. And so in New York City, we saw a 50% increase in misdemeanor arrests, and those arrests themselves can often be traumatic for citizens. At the time, in 1993, they were generally resulting in an overnight stay in jail and a strip search. Now, that policy has ended because of some litigation against the city and a $50 million award against the city for engaging in strip searching. But generally, these were kind of traumatic events for individuals. It wasn't just that they were getting stopped and being handed a ticket. It was that actually, because the tickets were being eliminated, they were actually being brought in. Many of them were spending the night in jail and being subjected to strip searches, which can be it can be a lot for somebody. But also, we also saw at the same time a approximately 60% increase in complaints of police misconduct. Now, complaints of police misconduct is not equal to police brutality, right? Because these are complaints, and some of them may not be founded. But nevertheless, it's a good gauge of how people are responding to the increased policing activity. So we saw a 60% increase in police in complaints of police misconduct. Lots of people who were being subjected to this racial profiling, the possibilities of racial profiling, and also just the bare fact that if you look across the United States, minorities are disproportionately arrested for these kinds of offenses. So if you look at the large cities in the United States with a minority population of about 13%, it turns out that a far higher percent are arrested for small crimes. So for instance, for disorderly conduct, it's about 37% African-American arrests. For prostitution, it's 38%. For vagrancy, it's 46%. So it's disproportionate. And so if we decide just to start focusing on those kind of offenses, it's going to have a disparate impact on African-Americans just because we decide to focus on those things. So those are, you know, a bunch of reasons why even if we weren't going to assume that, you know, policing itself might not have such an extraordinary impact on crime rates, the policing that we've seen under a broken windows approach has had these other kind of consequences.
Well, it sounds like it's the invasive approach that the police are using in violating constitutional rights rather than the fact that they're concentrating on minor kinds of crime. It seems to me that the original intent of this was to let people know that the beginnings of crime are not to be tolerated, rather than giving them an excuse to come out and violate constitutional rights.
Right. And so the big question, I mean, one big question that occurs then is it possible to have this kind of policing without the attendant civil rights violations, right?
Well, it seems like it's also, you know, as I first heard about this, and I'm not real well-versed, I've learned more today than I really thought I knew, more than I didn't know as much as I thought I did.
Mm-hmm.
And but what I understood was that you weren't necessarily going to arrest and give permanent records to everybody that you just let know that this was the wrong approach to starting your life. That was the kind of the feeling that I had this was all about. It was kind of to let people know, young people particularly, or those maybe delving into the areas of violations of laws and rules and regulations and things, and letting them know that we as a society don't like that.
Rather than
giving somebody a record when they're 13 or 14, even though it can be expunged, and getting them the feeling that they're criminals, I think that that can happen too. It sounds like what's happening with this is that it's being misused by police and policing peoples, and rather than the concept, but the application.
Mm-hmm. I see. Right. Well, I mean, that's an interesting point you make, because I think that there is that it is possible that the approach could have served that end in some sense. It could have you know, been used to put young offenders on notice, say that, you know, you can't get away with this kind of thing.
Yes.
Now, what's interesting, of course, is that the broken windows theory itself operates on a different kind of mechanism, or the idea behind the broken windows. Even if it, I mean, literally the broken windows theory works in a different way, and the way that it's supposed to work is by creating order, and the idea is that disorder sends a signal or has a certain meaning and is interpreted by people as having a certain meaning. And the meaning of disorder is that that the community is not in control, okay, and therefore it has this kind of effect on people. The law abiders take this meaning and then decide not to go on the streets at night, to stay in their homes, or to leave the neighborhood and go to the suburbs, say. And on the other hand, it has this other effect on disorderly people or criminals, that they can feel as if, you know, they can take the streets and that they're the ones that are going to be in control. So you raise an interesting, I think you're raising another possible side, a possible benefit of broken windows policing, which may not have been at the center of the theory itself, but which I think is something that's worth considering.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. I think that there's something else, and I think you touched on it a little bit earlier in the conversation, that one maybe want to consider when you're evaluating what are the goals of the approach and what actually happens. We talked about the fact that its increasing popularity also came at a time when people were concerned about the criminal justice system being overburdened.
Right.
And in fact, what seems to have happened is that by being aggressive on low-level crime, we haven't lessened the burden on the justice system. By dealing with higher-order crime, we've added to it, because
right.
we decided we're going to be aggressive on both levels.
Right. Exactly. Right. And so that raises two important points. I mean, the first is that as a result of that, a lot of our courts are completely clogged with, you know, misdemeanor arrests and whatnot. So that's something that we've seen in New York City, for instance, where the criminal courts are simply swamped because of the 50% increase in misdemeanor arrests, and that causes all kinds of complications and delays and administrative problems. And on the other hand, I think the other point you're making is precisely right, which is that this was in some sense intended to be a way of avoiding having to crack down on you know, three strikes you're out, mandatory minimums, etc. on the other end, and obviously we haven't seen a lessening of that. Although we have seen obviously sharp declines in crime since about 1991.
Hmm. We have about 10 minutes, or perhaps a bit less than 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Bernard Harcourt. He's Associate Professor of Law at the University of Arizona and at the moment is visiting Associate Professor at Harvard Law School. His book on the subject is titled Illusion of Order, The False Promise of Broken Windows Policing, published by the Harvard University Press, and again looks at this approach that technically is often described as order maintenance policing, but in the popular media has been referred to as broken windows, the broken windows approach, or the fixing broken windows approach, that argues that you can, by being really aggressive on low-level crime, you can have an effect on more serious crime. And he says that, in fact, when you take a look at the research that's been done, it's hard to back that up. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that you do in the book, in addition to looking at research that tries to ask this question, well, is there indeed this relationship between going after the low-level crimes and more serious crimes? And you find that, in fact, no, you can't. There's not a lot of research to back that up. You also take another step back, in a sense, and ask this question, well, why should it? I mean, what's the underpinning that we say theoretically says to us that if we did it, that this would work? I mean,
right.
How does one even start to make the argument that that approach would work before actually trying it?
Right. I mean, I try to explore kind of the theoretical underpinnings of the theory itself. And when you start to analyze the question of order and disorder, it seems as if things start getting a lot more complicated and very quickly. The fact is that the categories of order and disorder are themselves not very clear. What is disorder, right? Is loitering disorder? Certainly, for the purpose of the broken windows theory, loitering is one of the key kind of symbols of disorders, a key ingredient of disorder. And it turns out that actually, you know, in different cultural groups, loitering has a very different meaning. It doesn't simply mean disorder to people. A lot of people might want to hang out on steps in front of their home or something, congregate, chat, spend time together. And what some people might consider that, while some people might consider that as disorderly, a lot of others will simply think that that's the way one should, you know, lead one's life. And so the more you focus on these questions of disorder, the more complicated it gets. For instance, when we talk about the fact that New York became so much more orderly between 1993 and 1996, we talk about the fact that crime was decreasing. But at the same time, complaints of police misconduct were increasing sharply by 60%. So do we characterize this as a time of order? Or, focusing on complaints of police misconduct, do we characterize this as a time of disorder? And the more I thought about these things, the more I realized that the categories themselves of what we think of in terms of order and disorder are not, in some sense, pre-political. They don't just stand out there as existing for all time, for all people. And they are, in large part, shaped themselves by the kind of policing that we're used to. And by the kind of policing that we witness and we experience ourselves. And so there's this interesting kind of feedback loop where our views and perceptions about order and disorder may themselves be shaped in large part by the police techniques that we implement in society.
We have someone else to talk with in Chicago on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Thank you. With the tragedy of 9/11 upon us, we still have the ongoing tragedy of drunken driving, which is another kind of disorder that we seem to allow and yet have hardly had an impact on, considering the number of deaths that occur due to drinking and the untold tens of and hundreds of thousands of accidents that are occurring. Is there more that's being done in that area that could help change the situation in the way of monitoring drinking and so forth?
Mm-hmm. Well, that yes. I mean, drunk drunk driving is just a terrible, terrible crisis that we have.
Like a war that we can't solve.
Right, right. And in many ways, I mean, I would qualify kind of drunk driving and the injuries that occur as a result of that as being, you know, serious crime. So I wouldn't categorize it in the group of the minor disorder and minor misdemeanor offense.
It's a level that needs attention.
Right. Now, of course, the broken windows theory does have a piece of it that goes after kind of intoxication, right? Because oftentimes there are some kind of antecedents, say, to drunk driving, which might be something like public intoxication. And so something like a broken windows approach would possibly focus more on those kinds of crimes. But I would say that we just need to have a policy approach that focuses directly on drunk driving and an educational approach and a deterrent approach that would be just separate from these issues that we're talking about today.
Okay, thank you.
It seems to me that at least in the respect that in many states in recent years, what has happened is that they have lowered the legal limit of blood alcohol that you can have before someone will be considered to be driving under the influence, and have at least talked in public ways and in their public relations about the fact that it's something that's very serious and that they're going to be very aggressive about going after.
Right.
Well, we're just about at the point where we have to finish. Some last thoughts that you'd like to leave?
Well, I think that the whole issue of policing is going to have to undergo some significant rethinking as a result of September 11th. And these issues of minor disorder are also going to have to be rethought. A lot of resources, obviously, have been focused on these kind of disorderly activities. And one would have thought, well, maybe we should be focusing those resources on serious crime, more serious crime like armed robbery, etc. I think today we're going to be thinking more about focusing focusing our resources more on anti-terrorist activities.
Well, we want to say, Professor Harcourt, thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David.
Our guest is Bernard Harcourt from University of Arizona, currently visiting at Harvard Law School. His book is Illusion of Order, The False Promise of Broken Windows Policing, and it is published by the Harvard University Press.